discernment. It is a science and an art.
Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?
Nope, it is time for Too Wretched for Radio, perhaps the hottest subject in evangelical Christianity today, although there are a bunch of hot potatoes being bounced all over the place. Dr. James McDonald, Harvest Bible Chapel. Is it chapel or church? He's dubbed chapel. Harvest Bible Chapel. Not only is it a big church in Chicago, but they also have a number of satellite churches, not to mention a Harvest Bible Network, an affiliation of churches that have a relationship with them. In January, Dr. James McDonald, a preacher I suspect you've listened to for a long time. I know I certainly used to listen to him a lot. He stopped doing his radio program, removing it from hundreds, perhaps even over 1,000 stations, citing a change in demographics and financial stuff. So the ministry was showing signs that there are things going on behind the scenes, and indeed they are. Dr. James McDonald was recently fired. It appears that their elder board was about to deal with him, but it turns out it takes secular media sometimes to get churches to act. Mancow, he's a talk show host in Chicago, Mancow Muller. These clips that he had and he played on his program has Dr. James McDonald saying things that I think we would all agree that's not appropriate. The clips have him talking about a plan to put child pornography on the computer of Christianity Today magazine's chief editor, executive officer, I think it's Mark Golley, and about whether writer Julie Royce, who's been critical of Harvest, was having an affair with Mark Golley, editor-in-chief of the publication, calling him a name that I wouldn't repeat, snapping his fingers, stating he would be able to raise $100,000 in a minute. That is what was the final straw in a long history of James McDonald's stories, which have now led to his demise. And I think, Phil, the first thing that we need to recognize about this story, because we're going to try to skin this onion a little different today and not deal with the obvious stuff. We want to try to go at this in a way that's a contribution to the conversation. Bottom line, this is a sad story.
Yes, it is. It's one you've seen coming for a while. This is not the first rather public misbehavior by James McDonald, and it was actually a wonder to me that he wasn't dismissed several years ago when it came to light that he was involved in high stakes poker gambling in Vegas. And even before that, there was the many people will remember the Elephant Room, Elephant Room 2, when he invited T.D. Jakes and tried to sort of whitewash his errors. A lot of us back then, I think one of the persistent voices saying this is not something that should just be looked over lightly. It's a significant departure from historic Orthodox Christianity, and yet, you know, The critics, I think, took more criticism from other critics in the evangelical world. The critics got themselves in trouble with the evangelical public more than James McDonald did by sort of playing fast and loose with heresy like that. And that I thought was remarkable. You said something that it seems like it sometimes takes the secular media to get evangelicals to act. And it's true. And a shame, really, that evangelicals don't seem either able or willing to police their own movement doctrinally, morally, behaviorally. And James McDonald was on the cusp of a number of scandals like that that involved doctrine, behavior, practice, preaching, everything. There were lots of reasons before this to be deeply, deeply concerned. And yet it seemed to me that there were many more loud voices defending him and charging his critics with a lack of charity rather than actually looking at the problems and dealing with it.
Let us divide the issues into two parts. And I want to spend the least amount of time on the first. We're going to spend more time on the second list of concerns that people have observed about James McDonald, because one of the things about discernment that I think a lot of people forget is that, first of all, it needs to be a widespread story. This has certainly become quite a big deal in evangelical everything. So we're not spreading gossip here. We're talking about a already disseminated story. But second of all, we need to have something to contribute. Otherwise, zip, local church matter ultimately. So we want to make sure that we can contribute something. And that's what I want to do today, Phil, so that we can become better discerners, because there are rules to discernment. And yet, there can be some things where you kind of need to be a little bit patient, wait a little bit, see what comes to light. Maybe it was misunderstood. So there's an art and a science to this. And I fear that you've got people in two different ditches. One group of people who never judges anything, or they'll just judge the people who judge anybody. Or you've got people that just do this very poorly. Let us not be in either camp. So, Phil, here's the first category, and it's the subjects that you alluded to. James McDonald there were some theological concerns, specifically, as you mentioned, with the elephant room. He gave T.D. Jakes, who said flat out, "I'm not nuts about the term persons. I prefer the term modes or manifestations."
Manifestations.
Yeah, that was the big word, manifestations. And that's like, five-alarm fire that this guy's a modalist. It's the Sabellian heresy, and James McDonald gave him a pass. Was that enough, Phil, for either his church or the evangelical community to say he's done?
Yes, I think so. I mean, at least for the elders of his church should have acted on that and acted with both speed and firmness, because he was playing fast and loose with one of the cardinal truths of Christian theology. And he had actually several months warning before that event took place, where a number of us had expressed lots of concerns about T.D. Jakes's position, what he might say, how he might try to weasel out of the concerns about his doctrine. And it just seemed that McDonald sort of purposely, he went in there, I think, with an agenda to whitewash the difference. And that was troubling for a number of reasons. One, I think McDonald's own doctrinal instincts surely are better than that. He knew the importance of that doctrine. He knew surely at least what modalism is and how it has ravaged the church in centuries past. And yet he clearly had an agenda to sort of cover over that. Why? I don't know. But it seemed like that there was a turning point there with him, where prior to that point, his preaching, took a close and careful look at passages of scripture at times. I mean, he was no John MacArthur, but he was known as someone who actually opened the scriptures and taught from it. He wasn't just a sheer pragmatic storyteller.
Yeah, he wasn't Stephen Furtick by any means. So I want to ask this question, though,
but he became Stephen Furtick. I mean, after that, and in fact, really a year before at the first Elephant Room, he featured Furtick and Perry Noble, and they, again, were trying to sort of do away with biblical principles of church leadership and preaching. It was as if he had an agenda suddenly to sort of make doctrine a non-issue and church leadership philosophy a non-issue. He just wanted the freedom to do whatever it is he was going to do. And, you know, now we know some of what was going on behind the scenes. But the concern should have been there years ago.
You know, Phil, you and I were brothers in arms on that deal. We talked about the elephant room a lot because we were shocked at the pass that was given to T.D. Jakes. Absolutely shocking. But, Phil, issues, remember, they happen in time. So James was being warned. We didn't know what he was going to say. He gave a pass to modalism before saying, look, he's disqualified now. Would there be a time that we would wait to see what his church does to determine if he's dabbling in formal or material heresy?
Right. In fact, you said, look, this is a local church issue. Well, I would say it's primarily a local church issue. It is the prerogative and the duty of the local church to deal with it, first of all. But because James McDonald was a national character, he had a nationwide radio broadcast. He had a number of things that thrust him to the forefront of the evangelical community's attention. What he teaches, what he does, affects people who are in my flock. So I also have a duty as a shepherd to say something, to raise a concern when it's that
serious.
But
what I'm asking, I agree with you totally. But what I'm asking is, before we would say, James McDonald, turn off your radio when he comes on. Don't listen to him. You might want to think about another church. To have at least given the church some time to respond so that they could have qualified. Okay, why did you say that? Why didn't you say this? Are you agreeing that God is manifestations and not purpose? To come up with some clarification before just saying he's out of here.
Yeah. I think one of the, and I agree absolutely with where you're going with this. One of the dangers of ministries that focus primarily on discernment is that they tend to be very impatient, and they expect everybody else to be at the same place and in the same pace that they are.
Phil, you're getting ahead. That's next week's program. Quit reading my notes here. All right. I want to have one last conversation about this column of issues with James McDonald. You say theological. The other issues that seem to be surfacing that we heard through media reports is that James McDonald, for lack of a better term, was a spiritual bully. He was even repented in front of his congregation. I've heard a lot of people. I was pretty mean and nasty. Was that enough for us to say time out on James McDonald?
Well, that is more of a local church issue, I think, because the people who most closely affected are those close to him. But then others of us, I mean, I had a personal experience with his run-in with his angry side at one point. I won't go into detail on that. But in the wake of the Elephant Room thing as well, he put out some videos where it was clear that when he made those videos, he was out of control angry. He ultimately took them down because some of us pointed out that this is a very strange response to a theological critique. He lost his temper. There's no other way to say it. And, you know, I think we all lose our temper at times, or most of us do. So that in and of itself isn't automatically a disqualifying thing. But for a pastor, if he continues, if that's a pattern, if that's his style of dealing with conflict, it's a disqualifying factor. One of the requirements for an elder in the church is he's not to be pugnacious. He's not out there looking for a fight. He's not a brawler. And, you know, I think there's a fair question of whether on those grounds alone, James McDonald's elders, at the very least, should have been calling him on the carpet and holding him accountable. But it seems like they were intimidated by him, because the elders who actually did raise a question got dismissed from eldership in that church. And that was another pattern that was troubling, that when he had critics in his church who voiced anything, he would pretty much run them off. People were commenting about that for several years. So I think there were good reasons to be concerned.
He filed a lawsuit against the people that were running the Elephant's Debt website. All right. I want to jump categories here. And this is where I grant you that this has the potential to sound really nitpicky and perhaps a little bit hyper discernment-y. But nevertheless, I want to approach it with that mindset that these things can be tricky. There's another column that I've created for James McDonald, and these are almost all external things. What the headline for this column, Phil, has the question, do these things indicate a problem? And if so, how much and how do I deal with it? Are you ready for my list, sir?
I think so.
All right, about 8-9 years ago, something like that, I happened to be at the NRB convention in, I think it was in Nashville, and somebody was hosting a private event in one of those big suites, James McDonald. And I was invited to go in. There was food and fruit. You know the deal that happens at NRB, Phil. And yep. James McDonald was sitting there, and he was just, you know, kind of taking questions from folks and answering. And I wanted to encourage him. I think this was pre-elephant, if I'm not mistaken. And when I got up close to where he was sitting, I noticed his shoes and his clothing. That stuff wasn't cheap, okay? It was pretty flamboyant, and it was very expensive. And I remember being a little troubled about that. Never mentioned it, never brought it up. So why am I doing it today, to pile on the guy? No, but to ask this question, was that enough for me to go, I think I'm concerned about James?
Probably not by itself, but that with other factors, yes, would be. I mean,
okay, just hold on to that.
Another requirement for an elder.
Outward apparel. There were other times when you saw James and he appeared like in biker attire, very expensive, trendy glasses and sunglasses, that he was trying to look like, well, like a biker dude. Okay.
Right.
Those external things, do they play any role in how I view a pastor and judge him?
Well, sure, they do. How much they should and how quickly we should raise those concerns, I don't know. But I would say an accumulation of things like that definitely would be a concern, because as Scripture says, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. So if someone is wearing the badges of wealth and prosperity and he's focused on, I mean, this is our objection to the prosperity gospel, right? That they're focused on all these external things and in love with money, and that is definitely a spiritual concern. On the other hand, I don't think you can look at a guy and just say, well, okay, because he's using an expensive fountain pen, he must be a lover of money. And I've had people give me pens as a gift that I don't carry because I can't afford to lose them. But suppose I did, and somebody sees me writing with some Pelican pen that cost $250. If they concluded then that I am in love with wealth and that's the kind of thing I buy for myself, that would be a wrong judgment for someone to make. But so you have to be careful with that.
Okay. All right. Now, I'm not trying to be silly here. I'm really not, because there have been people that have been concerned about James for a long time, and I want to know if these external issues carry any weight, and if so, how much? Now, what if I happen to go to James' church, and every week, every time I see him, he's dressed like a dandy in designer clothing? Then can I be concerned? Because it wasn't just a pen where I could say, look, maybe it was a gift. He's driving in that car. It belongs to somebody else. But day after day, I see a presentation that indicates a love of worldly things. Can I talk about that?
You can. I'd be hesitant to draw a judgment necessarily. I mean, if you're talking about a pastor who writes books and you know he makes a lot of income off, say, royalties or whatever, there's nothing inherently sinful about wealth per se. What Scripture warns us against is the love of money. And it's not money itself that's evil. It's the love of money. And so I would have questions then if I saw a pastor who's sort of flashing the badges of, I could tell he's a prosperous man. Then my next question is, how generous is he? You know, what's his attitude towards, say, giving and charity, and how does he fulfill his own responsibility towards people with greater needs than he? Another concern for a pastor is if he's the wealthiest one in his church, that can be a problem as well. You know, it's kind of legendary with Dr. Criswell that before he died, because he'd made a lot of money off writing books, and he'd made some real estate investments that had gone very well for him in Dallas and all that. And so before he died, he actually donated back to First Baptist Dallas more than the amount they had paid him in salary over all those years. Every penny they ever paid him in salary, he gave back as a donation. And, you know, it's hard to fault that sort of generosity and all, and say, well, it was sinful for him to even have that much money.
The accumulation of money and inheritance for your children, you know, what those levels are, everybody has to figure that out for themselves. But if I see a pattern, for instance, and again, I never brought those things up, Phil, because I didn't think that it did qualify for, hey, look at this guy. He's wearing a Robert Graham shirt. You know what those things cost? They're like $2.50 a pop. Okay, we never did that. But I want to, looking back now, there were a number of things. When he showed up at the Shepherd's Conference, I think he was in biker shorts, if I recall. The goatee, which is a little bit untraditional. Are those things that I should put into my discernment basket to sift through?
Probably not, just based on an external observation. Styles are somewhat subjective, and I couldn't tell by looking at somebody's shirt how much they paid for it. I buy my jeans at Walmart, so there you go. I'm not sophisticated enough maybe even to make those sorts of observations. But yeah, I'd be hesitant to judge a guy's character based on solely on what he wears. But you have to then listen to what is it he's talking about? What is he concerned with? What does he do in his spare time as a hobby? And if, as in this case, it turns out he likes to go to Vegas and participate in high-stakes poker games, I'd say that's probably not a character you want as a senior pastor in your church.
All right. What about the home that he lived in? I can't remember the square footage, but it was quite a lavish lifestyle. Is that enough for me to go?
I saw a picture of it. I saw a picture of it at one point, and there's no other way to describe it other than to say it was a mansion.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was troubling to see that. You got to figure that he is living at a level that most people in his flock could never afford or appreciate. And there's a temptation, I think, for a guy in that position to lord it over the flock. And ultimately, the scripture says pastor shouldn't lord it over the flock. Ultimately, I would say if you wanted to put in one category what it was that brought him down, that was it.
All right. So I meet him at NRB. He's got fancy duds on. I let it go. He shows up at Shepherd's in the biker shorts. Kind of weird. I let it go. The goatee thing, which always looked just, you know, kind of a non-traditional facial hair growth. I let it go. The trendy glasses. I let it go. The house. Is there any point when I put enough of these things together, these external things, some of them preference issues, does a cumulative effect come into play?
Yes, but again, there's too much subjectivity to make any kind of rule on it. There's no way that an accumulation of concerns like that isn't going to affect how you think about a person. So those are all factors. I think one element of discernment is not to make speedy, hasty judgments based on external things like that. But when the external things fit with doctrinal concerns, behavioral concerns, all those other things, then yeah, they add up. It definitely makes a difference. And I need to ask you, should I shave my goatee? Is it an offense to you?
Maybe trim it just a bit.
That's what Darlene said.
Philosophy, a hardbound collection of all the life lessons I've learned.
God is not a Gumby action figure that you can shape any way you want.
Phil, have you gone mental?
Act like men, not like girls.
I've got a real clear message for the two of you on that. Stop doing it.
How about we agree to argue until one of us actually refutes the other?
Are you kidding me?